Hey guys, it's been a while since we've done one of these little intros, but this week we lost one of the Decay Brigade members, a huge friend, and an amazing person. Many people in the haunt community know Nelson Lee, and it's just really hard to put into words what this guy meant to so many people. But this podcast was recorded before, we found out about Nelson about a week before. And, so we don't get to mention him, but I just wanted to say, Nelson, we all love you. And you know, it just sucks that it always seems like the good ones are the ones that leave us way too early. I think everybody's in shock, and I just wanted to let everybody know that Nelson loved each and one, every one of you guys, at the entire haunt community, and it meant the world to him to be a part of the Decay Brigade, and he was just proud of everybody and everything that everybody was doing, and it's tough when we lose somebody, and it's even tougher when it's somebody that had so much of an impact on so many people. It's super late, and we just came back from his vigil at the rinks, and it's tough, you know. But on to the podcast now that I bummed you out. I love you, Nelson. I know Veronica does too, but she's passed out right now. She's tired. And we'll see you on the other side, buddy. All right, on to the podcast. Fog. I'm your host, Casey, and with me, as always, is the amazing Veronica. How are you doing, Veronica?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing great. And with us today, we have two special guests. We have Rick West from Theme Park Adventure and co-founder of Midsummer Scream. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and I'm here. I'm in the land of Corona with you guys.
Yeah, you guys made the
trek from Los Angeles, you bet.
I'm so impressed that you drove out here.
It was great. Oh, I owed you, right? We were supposed to do the last one in person, and that got balled up, so here we are in person now.
And then also with us, co-founder of UltimateHaunt.com and Knott's historian, Ted Doherty. How are you doing, Ted?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Good.
So let's talk about Midsummer Scream, guys. You guys were both involved in it heavily.
I hear it was a thing. I know a little something, I guess, about it. Yeah.
So we had a very small scope view of it. I didn't get to see a whole lot.
And I'm you sure and me you guys, both. You and me both.
You guys each kind of have. Maybe Ted had the most experience.
I think so.
I saw a decent amount of it, but probably not as much as I wanted to. I definitely missed some parts. Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was your favorite part, Rick?
Wow. That's a really tough question, because the answer is so multi-layered on that, right? The best part was pulling it off. Pulling it off and seeing it come off so successfully and seeing everybody just have such a great time. I mean, from watching the Hall of Shadows be built to seeing the vendors loading in on the show floor to being with people, you know, in the green room and then backstage in the theater before big presentations. Oh my God, the Black Cat Lounge was so stupid and crazy and adorable. It was ridiculous. To the very last minutes of the show, watching Ted's, you know, the Haunt 45 panel, you know, Scary Farm 45. That was definitely a highlight. And it's crazy because being in my boots, you really don't get to experience the show like anybody else does.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think, like the first day when we started, I didn't leave the big main theater until halfway through the day on Saturday. I didn't see anything. I was in the big theater the entire time getting things prepped for the Tower of Terror presentation. Mm-hmm. And then after that, we had other people coming in, and I didn't even make it over. I mean, I didn't even get to do Hall of Shadows. I did 4 haunts out of all of our haunts in the Hall of Shadows.
Nice.
And you'd think that I'd be like through all of them throughout the whole, and I didn't, just because time just evaporates.
Yeah.
When it's go, it's, we have to be a million places at all times. And I really, talking to you guys and seeing YouTube videos and listening to podcasts, that's really in the weeks and months after Midsummer, mm-hmm. how I really experience the totality of it.
For me, my favorite part of it really kind of almost was sort of the vibe of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Everybody, even if we were dashing from one point to another, one place to another, everybody was having a really, really good time. There was nobody that was like bumming out because they were in, you know, some long line or anything like that. Everybody seemed to be really, really stoked and happy that they were going through this experience together. From the very beginning, because I know, like, we walked by the long line of people waiting to get in, and everybody was just really, really happy just to be there. And so I think overall, the vibe is what I was most impressed with, just because when it comes to, you know, the presentations that we, you know, were part of and everything like that, and all the stuff that you were working on, Rick, overall, it's all geared toward entertaining people, making people feel good, educating people, whatever. It's all part, you know, they were really heavy on this one word that is very important: community. And there is this community that you can, it's almost tangible at this show.
It is, yeah.
And so, despite my head being in other places of like having to get prepared for XYZ or whatever, you know, ending up in one green room or another, whatever it was, or the show floor or the Hall of Shadows, everybody was having a very good time. And for me, it was just like, you know what? That kind of helped me kind of keep my cool with all of the things that I was kind of juggling around. It was just like, you know what? This place is great. Everybody's having such a good time, and there was such a really cool positive vibe around the whole thing. So that was kind of my sort of takeaway in retrospect, looking back on it.
Nice. So how was it for you guys the first time you guys walked out on stage at the Terrace Theater and looked at how many people were actually out there?
Yeah. So, well, the first time I ever saw the Terrace Theater, like from the stage, was Friday night. We had a technical rehearsal where we ran through the media aspects of Ted's presentation. And until then, I had only been on site once. And it was while the Terrace Theater was in use for something, and the theater was full, and I walked into the back, looked in, and yep, there it is, and then left.
Was that during the walkthroughs when all the kiddos were there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. You guys were there. So we all saw it. Yeah. And so I didn't go on stage until it was rehearsal time for the tech things. And we entered from backstage area and walked out, and fairly horrifying.
Yeah.
It's pretty cavernous. I mean, it's a really, really big theater. The plan all along was to see how much of the bottom section of the theater we could fill up, because there's two sections. There's the balcony, and then there's the bottom. The bottom is over 1,700 people. So we were like, dude, if we could fill that up at any point, we're going to be stoked on that.
Yeah.
And so we, a couple times, so like with Tower of Terror, which was our first presentation, we had about 600, 650 people in the audience.
It's not bad for like the first.
No, it was great.
Yeah.
And there were challenges, and we can get into that. There were challenges in getting people to the Terrace Theater. It was logistically more challenging in retrospect now than we thought it might be. Mm-hmm. And that will be addressed and corrected next year. And the thing that was the saving grace, and you might have experienced this also, the way that our chairs were, at least for the tower presentation, the lights were such that you couldn't even see people in the first audience, in the first row.
Wow.
So it was usually, I'm a sweat monster. When I'm up there, I'm like, oh shit, I'm like so nervous, and I start sweating, and then I'm like, dude, you're sweating in front of me. And then I start sweating more, and it's like, stop! It's a horrible spiral, right? And I got up there, and it wasn't like that at all this time. You could hear the audience out there, but you couldn't see them, so there was like this black barricade
That's
up.
Cool.
And it really helped. I didn't I didn't sweat at all. I was like so at home just talking to the guys on the tower panel. And I think it came off that way too. People seemed to really like that presentation. And it was interesting. There were presentations that were definitely more full than others. I think the biggest presentation was the Horror Nights presentation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was over 1,700. It seemed like it was pretty damn full.
Wow.
And then Ted's presentation was really full too. I would say that you guys had hundreds and hundreds. You guys had at least what the tower panel had, if not more, especially by the end of it. I mean, people were packed.
Yeah. Now, let me tell you my situation. So when we did the rehearsals on Friday night, I couldn't process it. Like, I was like taking pictures. I'm like, wow, this is like, but I couldn't register the scope of how big this stage was. I'm like, oh, you know, because if I thought about it too much, I'd really freak myself out.
Yeah.
Fast forward to Sunday for the Knots thing. We sat in, watched, the John and Chris presentation mm-hmm. for Horror Nights, and yep. it's like a lot of people and stuff. And so then went down. The green room for the theater is a little different, I guess, in the sense that it's on another floor.
It's like in the bowels. It's like the dungeon. It's really nice, but it's like a dungeon.
Yeah,
it's
it is.
Way down.
And so I basically brought like a little change of clothes so that way, like when I was walking around the show that day, I didn't have to wear what I was going to wear for the presentation. So mm-hmm. I found it like at this old dressing room area that had like rows and rows of like the mirrors with the light bulbs around them and all
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
And it was all empty and stuff because there was another room that actually had all the Six Flags characters in there. Yeah. I'm like, I can't go in there. So I just kind of kept going deeper into the theater. I'm like, oh, this will work. And there's this empty big dressing room area, and there was like a men's restroom area that had like showers and lockers and all. It was like this big thing for like, I don't know, if you were doing like a massive like theater production or ballet or something that had this huge cast or whatever. And I remember getting changed inside the little restroom area, and I'm like, just please don't be freaking haunted, because that's going to really throw me off right now. But there was that sort of moment where, like, I just stopped being, like, nervous or whatever. Like, my body's just sort of accepted, like, you're doing this, so just, you got to do it.
Calm comes over you.
Yeah.
There's like a point where, just switches, and that calm comes.
Yeah, because I needed to be sort of on when all of the Knott's Berry Farm or Scary Farm panelists were going to be coming into the green room. Mm-hmm. So I had to start, you know, before then. So that way I needed to just kind of check myself and make sure I was ready for all of them. And so there was this sort of calm and just kind of went through, you know, like it's almost like you just kind of, it's not like you go through the motions, you're aware of what's going on, but you're just kind of, there's this weird sort of, I don't know, almost weird vibe. That's positive, though. And so when the time came to actually go on stage and stuff, what I pictured is exactly what Rick described, which was, you know, kind of what you see like on TV where the spotlight's kind of maybe in your face and just this black curtain.
Yeah.
For me, no. I could see everybody. And then I'm like, oh, no. So, but it was okay because I was able to see them like shaking heads and acknowledging and almost sort of responding to things that we were discussing and talking about throughout the entire presentation. So it all of a sudden turned into like a discussion like this where we were like almost like in a living room, and we had all of these really amazing folks here talking about their portions of or contributions to Not Scary Farm's history. So it was just that's kind of where it turned into this kind of really kind of really relaxed type of situation. So that was sort of my take, sort of what my position was from what I was seeing during that presentation.
Cool.
How did you, as you were going through that and you were checked in and you were totally dialed in with everything that was going on, how did you transfer the energy from one speaker to the next speaker to the next speaker? I mean, it seems to just flow, but, you know, you're discussing kind of a different perspective for every different person. Like, how did you mentally change those gears?
Well, I mean, for starters, the panelists did have their questions beforehand. Okay. So I didn't know what their answers were going to be. But I told them, you're going to have approximately this much time to answer. Okay. So some folks went way shorter, which allowed others to go a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. And so the biggest thing was Gary that your executive director. Technical
yeah. Well, yeah, our executive producer
yeah mm-hmm. He was really amazing because number one, he's like the most like chill dude, and yeah. So like no matter how chaotic I was feeling, he always kind of made me feel like, hey, you know what, this is gonna be great, you know. It was just like, so that was number one. Number two, he I had asked about something, you know, of having some sort of timer or counter on stage that I could kind of see to be able to sort of, if somebody was going to be going, if somebody was going too long, it's like, okay, I know I need to start to try to mm-hmm. dovetail it to try to get them to wrap it up. So he was able to put that up. And quite frankly, I didn't have to use it very much because everybody, all the panelists were pretty, you know, They had sort of done their preparation knowing that, hey, you know, this is how much time you're going to have. So they sort of, they definitely put thought into what their answers were going to be. So that allowed it, I think, kind of help it go smoothly because I know Rick and I had talked about it. I had talked about it with some friends and stuff. I was like, okay, if any of these panelists start to really ramble, what am I going to do? How do I come off
yeah.
not looking like a total jerk by cutting some of these people yeah. off or whatever? So thankfully, I didn't have to do that. And so I think that was part of the idea. I think that was a result of sort of them being prepared to know how much time they had allotted.
Cool.
That's great. You can tell that they're passionate about it because they did put in that homework.
Mm-hmm. And make yeah, sure exactly. Yeah, day. Totally.
So what were some of the challenges that you had, Rick, while you were on the floor at the event, you know, anything yeah. interesting come up?
It sounds so cliche, but no. I mean, everything, it really is one of those things where if you really kind of, God, I don't want to jinx anything, but if you kind of are prepared, and we prepare pretty much for a year, you know, yeah. for this now, it kind of goes off like you expect it mm-hmm. to. You know, last year in 16, we had, you know, in the breakout rooms along the concourse there, we had the AC shut off because one of the rooms was using fog and it shut off. It set off the fire system.
Yeah.
And it shuts off the ventilation. So for on Saturday last year, those rooms like where Zombie Joe's and all that was, those were really freaking hot. I mean, mm-hmm. they were like saunas in there. And we made darn sure that didn't happen again this year, and it did not.
Yeah.
Hall of Shadows, there were never any issues with the amount of fog or anything like that in Hall of Shadows. Everything pretty much went off as we expected it. What we had discussed and were aware of, it was on our radar, but what we just wouldn't know until it was all in effect is how challenging it would be to move bodies from the main part of the convention center to the Terrace Theater.
Right. Yeah.
Terrace Theater, frankly, the ballroom, which we used last year upstairs, is a great, that's a great spot to have yeah. a main stage up there. It was not available to us this year. So when you're doing conventions, one thing that you learn very quickly is you don't always get the footprint that you want.
Yeah. yeah.
And in fact, there will be big changes coming for next year because only certain parts of the convention center are available, you know, when mm-hmm. we're locking this stuff in. Mm-hmm. I can say that we're going to return to the ballroom next year
nice.
As our main stage up there. That seats, I want to say it's over 2,000 in there. So it's still going to be freaking huge the way we have it set up. And Gary and the Call Brothers, that entire team does an amazing job setting up. The stages look beautiful
yeah.
when they do the lighting and the AV for all that, because that's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
Tower of Terror was the first presentation, and when we were supposed to have doors to the theater, I could look out from the terrace and still see the line of people trying to get in to the show because there were just so many people.
Yeah.
I could see it wrapping onto the bridge where people were supposed to be coming from to come to the theater.
Oh.
And so a little panic set in, and I looked out, and it was time to open doors to the theater for the first presentation, and there were like 50 people in line.
Oh.
And I was like, oh, shit, is this going to be really the way we're going to start Midsummer? Mm. And so quite honestly, there was a lot of semi-frantic communication between me and yeah. the team. And I said, we are going to hold this presentation because we are not going to have this tower presentation go off with 50 people in the audience.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen. And it was a matter of getting people physically checked in, which the check-in team, our line team and our box office team, all that stuff was great. They checked in. There was just a lot of freaking people.
Yeah. Yeah.
We did over 15,000 people this year. And so there was a security check, which was also kind of an added, you know, delay in getting people in, but that's the world we live in now.
Yeah.
And so anyway, we waited, we pushed it about, I don't remember, was it half hour? I think we pushed it past its start time. And by the time we started, we had 600-ish people, 650, whatever, in the audience.
So was it just that people were still trying to get in the door?
It was that. And also, you know, and we found this throughout the weekend, the panels that were really packed over there were the big, you know, the theme park ones were very big draws over there.
Yeah.
Because you have the dedicated fans.
Yeah.
I mean, you can hold the Horror Nights presentation in Timbuktu, and people are going to show up to Timbuktu to see the Horror Nights presentation. Other presentations, not so much. And in talking to people and observing things, it was just one of those things where if it's not in the same building where everything is, it's a commitment.
Yeah.
It's like when you go to Universal Studios and you're up at Harry Potter and then somebody says, hey, let's go on Transformers. Mm-hmm. You're like, oh my God, that's like a 3-day trek to Mordor. Right? So it's a time commitment. And, you know, the guests had to go along the bridge, which was still under construction. It was supposed to be finished months ago and was not.
Yeah.
So we were actually the first big show to get to use that access way. And even for us, we had a backstage access where we would run across from the Hall of Shadows to the back of the theater.
Right.
That was still a trek, though.
Yeah. It was.
And it was hot. It was a warm weekend. It wasn't as hot as it was in 16, but it was hot.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big ask of casual convention goers to say, hey, we want you to walk 7 minutes over to see this presentation that you may be into. And so I think that in a way, that was the Achilles heel this year. It was a beautiful theater. And oh my God, the tech team that comes with the theater, those guys were awesome. They were so good to work with all weekend. They were on it and they were fantastic. And so working in concert with them was fantastic. Ultimately, I think that the Terrace Theater was more of a hindrance to some of the panels than a plus. Yeah, we had a shit ton of seats and way more than we needed, you know, for this year.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, moving forward, absolutely the object of the game is to keep everybody as close together as possible. Because you can look up then, when you're in the concourse, you can look up and say, oh, there's a big line forming up there. I wonder what that is. Or, oh, I better get in line now because the Horror Nights presentation is lining up. Or Knots, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a huge advantage that we will see, you know, in 18 when we return to the ballroom for our big presentations.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I probably gave Shannon a little bit of a heart attack with the class because I had like 3 texts and a bunch of missed calls from her. Because it was like right after one of the Decade Brigade shows.
Yeah.
And so we started to tear apart because we had a lot more technical props and stuff. So there was a lot of turnaround that I had to get ready before we went to the class. So it was like we were tearing everything up really quick and then we ran up there and we got there. We got there like 5 minutes before the class started.
Okay,
but it worked out. But yeah, I think she was a little like freaked out.
And how did your class go?
It went great.
This is me asking you for the very first time.
Yeah, I want to know too.
Was it good?
It went really good. I don't know how many seats were in the classrooms, but we
900.
Were, okay, so 900.
They don't know if they're listening. They weren't. Yeah, so 900.
What? Between 80 and 100, maybe?
Yeah, I don't know. We probably about half, or just a little over half filled the classroom.
Okay, that's great.
Which is way more people than I was expecting.
Well, that's great.
I think there was more people than
And the room wasn't hotter than hell, so that's good. No, that's a win.
It was great, and people were really engaged, asked a lot of really good questions. I did a video that we put up on YouTube on how to actually cut the conduits for the gloves because I didn't want to sit there grinding metal in the middle of the show. But everybody seemed to really love it. We got a lot of compliments on it, and people were glad they knew how to make them now.
That's awesome.
We had other monsters with us. So Casey was there and I was there, and then we had Gary Spaz and then Sebastian, who was the star of all 3 of our shows, which I thought was hilarious because Sebastian is a mime and he didn't say a word through the entire presentation.
Yeah. And so we had Spaz who interpreting is what he
said. Oh, that's great.
And he's an endless font of knowledge. He's like he's like the Ted of like the sliding world. He's just knows everything about everything.
Yeah.
And he definitely had a lot to contribute when it came to different options for the gloves and different ways to do it, because I mean, your equipment is as unique as you are as a slider or a performer. So he was really able to put in some different perspectives, you know, along with his own. He's got these massive things. He was able to see from the technical standpoint because he is actually a genius, right? Yeah. Like on paper, he's a genius.
Mm-hmm. He's ridiculously smart. Yeah, oh, yes.
Yeah. And so that was really helpful. And then awesome. Sebastian has his stuff too. And then my side, which is like the opposite side of Gary's, which is very dainty and as low pro as possible. And, you super know, everything from like the girl perspective anyway. Yeah. So
that's
with
important,
all of that,
I think that's absolutely important that you had your perspective in that.
Yeah, it was, I mean, everyone's part in it made it as awesome as it was because you had, I mean, I also have Xander. So mm-hmm. we have his perspective. He wasn't there that day. I wish he could have been there, but we had his gloves. And there were lots of kids in the audience who wanted to know how to do what they did, but they didn't want to use those big old like machine washers.
Okay, yeah.
They needed smaller versions. So we were able to actually show them how to do that entry level little kid sized you know, equipment into the world. And then it kind of spun off a little bit into, you know, well, what about pads? What about toe caps and everything like that? And we wanted to continue, but we knew we only had so much time. So it was more like a, we'll save that one for another panel kind of thing, but we did kind of give them a little bit to get started and then, you know, look on YouTube or, you know, follow the Decade Brigade. There's going to be tons of this stuff in the future, like that kind of stuff. So it did branch off a little bit. And then, of course, you know, that how do we join the Decade Brigade, which is we hear all the time.
Yep.
So we were able to daintily veer away from that every time it came up.
Wow.
That's great. I'm really glad that worked out well for you guys. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Do you know, did anybody record the class? Is it on YouTube or anything? Or?
I don't think so.
No, I don't think we thought of it.
I just wondering if the guest did or somebody, you know.
One of the guests, the one, I can't remember what his name was, but he was in the front row on the, looking out on the left side.
Mm-hmm.
He was recording parts of it.
Okay.
But I don't know if it was just for him to use
sure.
or
yeah.
if he's going to put it anywhere.
Well, I think it's great, and just recently, I'm so behind in my podcast listening, because I have a list of podcasts that I listen to religiously. Maybe a week or two ago, it was the episode when we were talking about your upcoming class at Midsummer,
yeah.
and how cool it is, because once upon a time, and Ted will remember, this was taboo. Unless you were a slider, you did not know how to make slider gear.
Yeah.
And so to see it come 180 to being taught a class at a major convention, that was really cool to see that evolution.
Yeah, I agree. And I listened to that same episode and I really agree with, and I really like Veronica's response to that idea that it was taboo to talk about mm-hmm. for so long. And it was this really closely hidden secret. But I liked what you said. You said that, you know, we rather teach them how to do this right and
yeah.
safely instead
yeah.
of, you know, busting open their arms and all that stuff or
right.
their hands and all that. So if there's anybody that are professionals in sliding, it's you guys. And so you should be the ones that are going to be doing it. And I'm glad that you guys are because we know that it is a global entertainment performance type of scare tactic or show element or whatever. Mm-hmm. And over the years, even people like in Ocean Park and Tom Merman, all those guys, you know, I mean, they basically were watching YouTube versions and
yeah.
kind of coming up with this stuff on, you know, well, it kind of looks like they may have done this, that, and the other, but
mm-hmm.
it's not really right. They were just kind of going based on the little clips they could see. So I think it's really awesome and important that you guys are kind of sharing the important knowledge, because at the end of the day, it's out there.
Yeah.
yeah.
So it's
yeah.
It's no longer proprietary. It never was.
No, it never was. No. And so now that it is out there, all right, let the people that know how to do this, that are the most experienced, share the knowledge on how to do it. So that's, I totally agree with you guys on that.
And what's cool, going up and beyond Midsummer, let's take it the next step. You guys took a little trip.
We did. Let's talk about that.
What do you guys want to know? Well, people that don't know that are listening, what happened after Midsummer?
Well, the Decay Brigade was hired by Six Flags Over Texas. We went out to Arlington, and then we basically trained their slider team. Last year, they had sliders for the first time, and they realized that they didn't know exactly what they were doing, both the park and their monsters. So they were like, Robert, who is part of Live Action Productions, he runs the talent out of Six Flags Over Texas for Fright Fest. He also does Chill at Queen Mary, and then a bunch of other events around the world. He was at Midsummer last year and saw our show. And so they basically invited us out to come and help get their team in shape. And we pretty much started from ground zero, like at Knott's. We basically did a safety test with them. We went through gear and how to use it properly. And a lot of them, when they were landing hands first instead of knees and hands. And so we were working with a lot of how to actually land on the ground properly, how to kind of escalator down instead of just slamming down on your knees so you don't damage your knees. Yeah, we had a lot of stuff to go there. And then after that, they wanted to go one up and they wanted us to put together a show for them. So not only did we have to go from ground floor working with them how to scare slide, they then wanted to add in trick sliding. And she was more part of the trick sliding stuff, so...
Naturally. So, do you remember John Urbano?
Of course I do.
He moved to Texas a couple of years ago for work. And then he got the bug again and ended up working for Six Flags Over Texas. And he essentially brought the sliding to them and was like, this is a thing, this is amazing. Also, I know some guys who are really good, you know, let's get them out here. So after the basics were done with the making sure they know how to get up quickly and evade and roll out and all that good stuff, we started doing things. Basically, we just took the Decade Brigade's latest show, broke it down into its unique stunts, and then taught them one by one to the people who most quickly adopted various skills. Because everyone's kind of good at one thing or another, yeah, more so. So we kind of split the stunts with everyone who is particularly good at one thing or the other. So we had we had mostly partner stuff, because that stuff to the audience looks more dynamic, even though to us it's usually a more simple trick. So we did that, and basically for them, they were, like, once they learned how to slide, and this is typical for sliders anyway, is you learn how to slide, and you do the thing, and then you stand up, and then you're just kind of there. And nothing really much follows up. It's kind of like the typical porch slide, you know, from way back when, is you scare and you stand up and then you just walk back. And we were like, no, 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 none of that. So what we needed to teach them was how to build choreography is still kind of a strong word, but just sequences of things. You're going to do this trick and then this trick and then this trick. And so you want to keep that energy, even if you're not moving, you're keeping that focus and that energy moving forward so that the audience keeps going forward. Because when you stop and your energy stops, they kind of go, you know, and the energy just drops. So as far as building a show, you want to always keep that energy moving. And that was the big focus after we taught them the basic stuff was, okay, this trick is going to lead into this trick, which is going to lead into this trick. And here's why, from the technical standpoint of like executing the stunt, and then how to keep the energy flowing attitude wise going from one trick to the next to the next. So we did tricks like Ruth and I do the thing where we run at each other and we grab hands and it makes us spin in a circle really quick. We found two sliders who did that really well, so we made sure that they did that stunt.
Cool.
And then we had some that were just naturally really good jumpers. So we had them jumping over other monsters who can run down and had more control laying themselves down, so that, you know, we're kind of matching everybody up with their different stuff. And everyone got to, like, they leveled up really quick. Because kind of like when you're dungeon running and you've got a low-level character and you're running with a bunch of high-level characters, you're going to level up really quickly. That's basically what happened with these kids, was they were surrounded by these guys that, you know, have capped out level-wise, and you're bringing up all these new characters, and they all got so good so fast.
That's cool.
And I think that they saw that because we took some video to kind of show their progress. And at first they were very kind of stutter-steppy, and like they weren't afraid to hit the ground because they had their pads. They knew what they were doing there, but they were afraid of messing up. And after we show up, I mean, we mess up more times than we pull it off because it's fun, and that's how you push the envelope. They saw that, and they're like, oh, it's okay to mess up. It's okay to fall. Because one, it's funny, and you can laugh at it. And another thing, it kind of shows you where your boundaries are, where you need to work, and where you can excel. And it's always like what they call pushing the rock. You're running up the hill, you're always trying to push the rock farther and farther each time. So these kids adopted it and they did it. And by the time showtime came around, we didn't know what music they were going to choose. They just put on some awesome music. And so
So we were there Friday. We worked with them for 4 or 5 hours straight, which is a long time to be sliding.
Yeah.
And hot.
And hot.
It was hotter
than hot to hell, right?
August in Texas, guys.
It was like 80-something percent
humidity and 100 degrees outside.
Oh, God. Cool. Yeah.
But we were in their magical music amphitheater, which is like this big amphitheater where they have like Justin Bieber's perform there and stuff like that. So it was this big covered stage, and they brought out on each end of the stage these giant swamp coolers. So it helped a little bit, but also gave a really good target to crash into, these giant swamp coolers. So you had to be able to stop really quick. But so Friday we worked with them a lot, and we didn't know. We came in Saturday morning, and we thought, okay, we're just going to be working on the show with them because they want to do this demo show, so we're just going to keep working on that. But we show up, and they're like, oh, no. We're going to do it in the park with guests and everything. So the Gotham City section of the park, they basically made an announcement, hey, we're having a Fright Fest demo in the Gotham City area of the park, just so everybody knows there's going to be monsters out there. So they put their characters in full makeup, full costume, in August, during the day.
Oh, my God.
And we went out there, and they were scaring the crap out of people.
Wow.
It was like shooting fish in a barrel. But,
yeah.
So they were out there for a little bit just to kind of get a crowd gathering. And then once we had a good amount of people around, we did a slider show.
Yeah.
And but the whole Decay Brigade were just in their street clothes.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was cool. We did like a little thing where they showed off what they could do. So they got like the first 5 to 10 minutes, mm-hmm. and then the Decay Brigade and them did some joint stuff together. And then the last like 10 minutes of the show was just Decay Brigade doing crazy tricks. And the crowd was way into it. By the end, they got into it.
That is so cool. Wow.
And I would venture to guess that the crowd in Texas, I mean, outside of Southern California, other haunts, even though they're a large scale at these theme parks and amusement parks or whatever, they probably haven't seen the level of sliding that we have here in Southern California.
It did not appear that they had seen that before.
So they must have been, suffice to say, they were pretty mind blown
at
what you guys were doing.
Yeah.
That's so amazing. That is so great. And I think that that is just so important to see the community reaching out from Southern California across corporate, you know, boundaries, you know, to the different haunt communities throughout the country. And I'm so proud of you guys. And I think that is so cool.
Yeah.
That is so rad.
Totally.
It was fun.
I know this is where the Decay Brigade wants to go now. Like, I mean, originally it was Spaz who called up Paul Frechette and was like, hey, you know what would be fun? And just get a group together and slide, just like the pre-show, but we'll do it in other places. And then it kind of grew and grew and grew. And then it kind of, it absorbed these really enthusiastic members, really ambitious. And they're like, I think that we can do more with this. And that's how like the complex show production and getting all the different elements involved came around. And then once we brought that out, then people really started to notice. And so now we've got producers, we've got showrunners, we've got all these different people reaching out to us, like, we want you to do what you do.
Yeah.
And that is, I mean, I remember the first time I slid, Ted was there. I never thought in a million years that I'd be doing it in front of, you know, hundreds of people.
Yeah,
never that's awesome. in my wildest dreams.
And you just think about it, we all have grown up with sliding, mm-hmm. and we knew what it was like before. I don't know if you guys remember, you might remember,
yeah.
but... We remember what sliding was like before there was ever such a thing as a pre-show.
Yeah.
And so it was just literally just the scare tactic. And so it's really crazy to see how it's grown. And it's fantastic to see that you guys are you know, running with this and keep going.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see where it's going. I know we have a couple more events now coming up. I don't know if we're allowed to say it, but what the heck. We're doing something for Snapchat. Snapchat's having a big event in LA. And then also, I think, Maxim Magazine.
I don't know if that one's set in stone.
I'm not sure
yet,
if that one's set in stone,
but
it's being talked about.
But you're talking to people.
Yeah.
And that's fantastic. That is so... Kudos to the entire brigade. That is so exciting for you guys. So proud of you guys.
Yeah, totally.
They work their butts off to be at the level where they are.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So, yeah.
Exciting.
Yeah. So let's switch gears.
Yeah. Okay.
We'll move over to Ted.
Okay.
Hi, Ted.
Hi. How are you doing?
All right. Okay.
So you've been working a lot in the VR space.
Uh-huh.
You're working with Larry Bones on Into the Black.
Yep.
And other things. Where do you see VR going in the haunted attraction industry Do you think it's going to be a bigger part of it? Is there anything interesting you guys, you can tell us about where it's going?
Well, I mean, I think it is rising a little bit in the haunted attraction community. I think there, because there already are, at least in the United States, a good handful of haunted attractions that have some sort of VR component, but a lot of them are based on sort of off-the-shelf types of things that you can buy for, like, Vive or whatever.
Yeah.
So the stuff that, you know, we're working on a more, well, at least for me, the stuff that I'm personally working on is the live-action stuff that's not as much, you know, the game engine-driven CG types of things as much. So it's more of kind of like what we were talking about before, more of like a VR horror experience where it incorporates VR elements mixed with some sort of pre- and post live show element. So we're sort of using VR as a tool to place the a viewer into another realm, world, or whatever for a brief moment. But at the end of the day, they are still engaging with some sort of live element, either before or after the experience. And I think that's something that, we're excited about just because it's something that we feel has it's something that people seem to really kind of respond to.
Yeah.
You know, because our experiences definitely do not take place in the living room. You know, it could be anywhere from a haunted attraction, a Halloween theme park, a cemetery. It doesn't really matter as long as there's a sort of inherent underlying base of fear before you put those goggles on.
Right.
How do you thematically make the transition? Because that was one of the things, like, we did the I did the Annabelle experience and the It experience. There was no like thematic reason why to put on these goggles. So do you try to build in ways to like make it make sense? Or is it just one of those things that's hard to switch to?
Well, I mean, like when we did Fear VR, there was no reason for it.
Yeah.
But for Into the Black, there is reason for it.
Okay.
Nice.
I mean, I could tell a little bit. I can't say too much about it, but the idea is, well, for those who don't know about Into the Black, it's Larry Bones' sort of brainchild. Larry Bones, former head of makeup for Universal Studios Halloween Horror Nights in Hollywood. So he's kind of branched out on his own and has created this sort of multi-level haunted attraction sort of experience that entails sort of four elements. A short film that he debuted at Midsummer Scream, an actual physical haunted attraction that people have to walk through alone that will be open at the Pomona Fairplex October 6th, I think is when it opens, as well as a documentary on the making of all of this stuff. And then the fourth component is a VR horror experience. And sort of the backstory of the haunted attraction is outlined inside this the short film that he did, where it's these sort of paranormal investigators looking for this infamous black house that was rumored and had all these sort of urban legends wrapped around it that, you know, whether or not this thing existed or whatever. So I won't ruin the movie for you, but in a basic nutshell, they do find this horrific place. And so the VR component is a pre-show to all of that.
Okay.
And it is sort of stepping into a paranormal research facility that allows viewers to be attached to haunted inanimate objects.
That's a cool idea.
And through the use of these VR goggles, we'll be able to sort of attach ourselves to an inanimate objects rumored to be part of or found in the House of Black. And so so there is a reason for the VR goggles there. That's probably what I can say about that. So that's, I don't know if that answers your question, but that we're trying to, that is somewhat of a segue.
Yeah.
But I think for like It and Annabelle or, you know, Flatline VR and all those different types of things.
Yeah.
There's not really so much of, you know, these are magical goggles that you're going to be putting over your head. Yeah. And, you know, all of a sudden we're supposed to be like, oh, okay, these are magic goggles. Mm-hmm. You know, so it, pretty much for the most part, you're very aware that you're going into another world when you're putting the goggles on.
Because I always thought it'd be cool because there's, you guys, they announced the VR thing they're doing in Downtown Disney for Star Wars, right?
Yeah.
So I always thought that those guys had a really cool idea. They did one that was a zombie apocalypse one up in Utah, and they actually made the VR goggles look like a gas mask. And so the idea was, is you're going into this area that's infested with this virus, and you need these this gas mask on. So you pop the gas mask on, it's actually your VR goggles, and then you go into the world. And I thought that was a really cool kind of way to make it thematically make sense to what you're experiencing.
Was that part of The Void? Did The Void do that?
No, we are very, we know the guys at The Void, and yeah, that's a way to do it, you know, to sort of hide them, you know, through a mask or whatever. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people that are sort of experimenting with ways to try to bridge that gap of trying to say, all right, you are putting on goggles and we are going to put you in an artificial sort of world. But yeah, that is, you know, The Void. I don't know if they did anything with Ghostbusters as far as a reason why you're putting the goggles on, other than, I don't know.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. Johanna did it
in New York, and
she said it was amazing.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if they had anything in Ghostbusters that was like goggles that they put on, but now I'm thinking of like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Yeah,
I think maybe a
story conceit would be this helps you see the ghosts, you know, the ghosts before they materialize or
right.
There's I think for people to buy off on it and be all in as far as, you know, just letting themselves go, just even a thin story bridge.
Yeah,
something.
But also we're at the point where if you're going to, you know, Haunted House VR. Well, you know, it's VR.
Yeah.
So you know you're already buying it. You know what you're going into, right? If you go into something that is, you know, Welcome to Cranston Manor, that's an old Apple game my age and older. If you go to something, you know, like Cranston Manor, Haunted House, and suddenly you're just given these big VR things, but it can be kind of off-putting. Like, okay. So it always helps when there's a story conceit.
Yeah. No, I agree.
And for Rick, where do you see... Because I think... they've mentioned that the Millennium Falcon attraction at Disney is going to be have some kind of VR component to it. I'm not sure if that's gone now or if that was just a rumor way back.
I don't know. I mean, I don't work for WDI. I just think for capacity's sake, I don't know that that's a component of the Falcon attraction. I know that they are focusing on that in Downtown Disney and Disney Springs.
That could have been the two things, and they mashed the rumor
together. Yeah, and I kind of thought that they were sort of not interested in using VR inside the parks because of the throughput problems. But in you know, Downtown Disney,
it's a
better spot for it because people will know about it. They'll, you know, so should they want to go check it out, they can. But they're not backing up a line for 3 hours inside the park.
And also get people into Downtown Disney.
Yeah, sure.
But
and
where
you can do it, you can do upcharge that too.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how, because you're going to thin the herd, and the only way to really thin the herd is to either age restrict and or upcharge something, right?
Yeah.
So you're going to see that, I'm sure, maybe both of those implemented for the Star Wars thing. Mm-hmm. So people know, you know, maybe we do a reservation system. We got to come back at 3 o'clock, you know, type of thing, because it will be crowded, and it's not a fast process with any kind of VR stuff, yet anyway. And I'm really curious to see it and check it out.
I'm excited to see it too.
I think that there is a certain time and place for VR. I think that you're going to see it expanding more into the home gaming consoles. That certainly is a no-brainer for that. I've got mixed feelings on that as well, but overall, fairly positive experience with that. I was at Gabe Montoya's house, and they do Theme Park Duo, and I did the Star Wars, the VR, you know, the Battlefront, you know, stuff, and I played for like an hour. I played through the whole VR thing that they did, and then I took the headset off, and I was like, that was really great. oh shit, I feel really queasy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then Gabe's like, well, you know, they say when you first start, you should do it like in 5 minute bursts or whatever. I'm like, dude, I've been playing for an hour, you know? And I was nauseated like all the way home and the rest of the night. Yeah. And I thought, ugh, okay, well, that's something maybe it's an age thing or something that I just really need to ease into type of thing.
We did the Ghost Town VR at Knott's.
Yeah.
And I wasn't bad queasy, but I was a little tiny bit dizzy after.
Sure. I think it's easier to digest in smaller bits.
Yeah.
Like that. Because that's like, what, 5 or 6 minutes or whatever
you're doing. It's a very short segment.
Yeah.
And I've done that, and I think that was a lot of fun. But it was really funny because it wasn't until almost the thing was over I realized, oh, shit, I can turn around. There's a whole other thing going on behind me. I'm busy blasting away at stuff in front of me. And I'm, you know, Johanna's like, behind us! And I was like, what do you mean behind? Oh, behind us! Yeah. Behind us. So being in a cave, you know, that takes a little getting used to. But I think we'll see that progress. I really am of the mind, I have not seen anything in a theme park or an amusement park setting where I think it's really successful. You know, Six Flags has gone all in on adding these to the coasters and that type of thing. And, you know, kudos to them if it's working for them. I see that it's an operational nightmare. It backs up the line. It's just, and at the end of the day, if it's a rad coaster, you just want to ride a rad coaster, you know? And I just, augmented reality, which is a whole other podcast and a whole other difference. Yeah. I think that augmented, you bet, night and day, we could talk about adding that into theme parks.
That would be amazing, ways. Yeah.
VR, I think, is very limited in its current form.
Yeah.
Is very limited, in a theme park setting.
I've heard good things about the Dan Brown experience is it Dan Brown? The one that's over in the UK?
Thorpe Park or whatever, or Alton Towers or whatever. Yeah.
Oh.
It's called Ghost Train or something
That. It's something brand. Darren Brown. Ghost Train. I know that they've gone through two iterations of that now. They added like an alien component or something onto it now. Hmm. And that apparently it's better that way. And then, you know, Nolan Bushnell, who was the founder of Atari, he has a company that's really getting into VR stuff now, and I just heard him interviewed on this.
Mobi or mobile? Starts with an M.
It's an M word. I just heard him do a really great interview with Doug Barnes on the Season Pass.
Yes.
And talk about a smart guy. I mean, he was talking about, my head was spinning. I was like, Jesus, this guy is like on such a different playing field, and he is so forward thinking on this.
Well, you gotta think Atari, Chuck E. Cheese.
Yeah, well, the stuff that he's working on has got to just be, you know, nothing short of voodoo. I mean, I'm sure it's going to be pretty freaking rad, whatever his company is coming up with. I think it has a very interesting arc that we're following. I think it's an exciting time to be into themed entertainment as well as, you know, video gaming. Mm-hmm. And I think that as we're looping back to what Ted's talking about, I'm really curious to see how Larry implements this into the Black. And I do think that there is a really cool marriage that can happen between VR as well as AR and haunt type environments.
Yeah. I think it's more controlled too. So the throughput isn't as bad if you design it right.
Well, and like what Rick was saying, if you thin the herd with upcharges and all that stuff, age requirements, that helps things out a little bit.
That's one thing I like that Larry Bones is doing, is that the haunted attraction and movie is like one price, and if you want to do the VR, it's a little extra, but you can pay for it if you want it.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So the story kind of can still be told even if you don't do the VR part?
It can be told, but to get the complete story, it's all four, well, aside from the documentary, so all three elements together tell the complete story. So you'll miss things if you don't do the VR, but I don't think it's going to like ruin the haunted attraction.
Because I know with VR, there's like an age requirement, right? Like you have to be 13 or 14 to be able to use it safely. Yeah.
So it's going to be 13 and above to do the VR.
Yeah.
Why is that?
It has to do with how their kids' eyes are developing up until the age of 13. And if they use VR, it can actually, a lot, obviously. Yeah. But if they use it, it can actually hinder the development of their eyes. And so basically, the optometrist and stuff has said, 13 and up.
That's
pretty much where it should be at.
And then that's required also by like Oculus, Samsung, all that stuff.
Yeah.
So like, let's say we decide to go to Magic Mountain, do the Revolution thing, but they, you wouldn't see a kid going on it that's under 13.
You'd think I would know. I didn't know. So there, I learned my thing for the day.
There you go.
There you go. Right here on the podcast.
That just sounds so incredibly disorienting to have virtual reality on a roller coaster. I mean, I'm still trying to wrap my head around
that. Have you guys done it?
I have not. I'm not. Rick and I have talked pretty openly about it. I'm not a big fan of that for roller coasters. I know Six Flags is all lame. Cedar Fair, I think, is fairly in at least at some of their other parks. So I'm not really a big fan of it. But I've heard, you know, I mean, okay things. Nobody's like blown away by it. I mean, you can kind of watch YouTube videos or whatever of the content and see. You can really kind of imagine what it's like. But because the roller coaster's on a fixed track and all that stuff, that's how they're able to really match that content to it. So that really helps avoid or minimize the chances of people getting motion sick.
Yeah, the technology is pretty locked in as far as tracking where the train is and what you're seeing, connecting that to what you're seeing. What the coasters are really doing is it's replicating the G-forces that you're feeling. So if you're watching a movie and your, you know, Astro Fighter plane that you're riding in does a big, you know, inversion and you're actually doing that. Yeah, that really helps obviously replicate and put on the G-forces on your body, the actual physical what's going on that you're not going to get sitting on your couch playing the PlayStation or anything like that. So I get that part of it, and when it's done right, it's an interesting. We'll leave it at interesting, right? it's not something that I'm like jumping up and down excited to do over and over again. Yeah. I've done that once or twice on Revolution, and that was good for me. It's like I was more excited that the Revolution trains are beautiful, and we can enjoy a true classic coaster once again without feeling like you're in a torture device, right?
Exactly.
So, you know, and Kraken at SeaWorld in Orlando just got the VR overlay, and Kraken, I love Kraken. That's a great coaster. And so, to me, it's kind of the opposite effect, and it could be my age group. It could be the fact that I've gone on Kraken for years without the VR. I just look forward to riding Kraken.
Yeah.
You know, I don't need that extra level of, you know, graphics that probably aren't much more than like a PlayStation 2.
I'd be more interested if it was actually like a dark ride. Like if someone did a horror themed dark ride.
Sure.
But then they had you put VR goggles on, they could actually tailor it to age groups. So they could put like, if you have a kid, you can bring them, put them in the VR goggles. It's a much less scary experience than you're getting in your VR goggles.
Sure.
I think that'd be a cool way to kind of make a family-friendly attraction, but tailor it to the age group that's going on it.
Mm-hmm. So do the same rules apply for AR as for VR when it comes to the age group?
That I don't know.
Because, I mean, if it's just like an overlay, maybe it wouldn't be so hard on the eyes.
I don't know if it's
eyeballs.
Out there. I don't know if they've tested it in the masses the way they... I mean, because with the HoloLens and all that stuff...
They're very guarded on it. Yeah. Nobody's really seen the Magic Leap. HoloLens, a few people have seen it.
Well, we've got... You know, yeah, I mean, it's out there and stuff, but it just isn't to the masses where they've probably done that type of testing.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm guessing if there's some sort of medical reason why, you know, any sort of... element is that close to a child's eyes, then it's probably going to apply the same way, I'm guessing. I don't know.
Well, the important thing also when we're talking about AR, it doesn't necessarily have to be with glasses.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. So you can theoretically go to Ghost Town Alive 2020 and use your smartphone, use the camera on the smartphone, and you can go searching for the Catawampus in Ghost Town. And you're looking at the camera pass-through on your screen, and oh, there's the Catawampus over by the Birdcage Theater, and you can see it run away, and you have to follow it that way. So it doesn't necessarily, like VR, you're pretty limited at this point to your goggles.
Yeah.
And usually bulky goggles.
Right.
And AR, the beauty of that is it can be your phone, it can be, you know, and I'm sure it'll be implemented on things that are like, you know, the Google Glasses, you know, type thing.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, the exciting thing for augmented reality. To ride one of these days. Well, hell, they're destroying it anyway. So let's say riding through Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, and actually see all sorts of effects overlaid so that you can see this. There's explosions in the burning city. And in the ship battle, you know, against the fort, you can see pieces of the fort falling off when the cannonballs hit it and all that.
Yeah.
So that's the beauty of the AR.
No, versus, I totally agree. Yeah, and I think that's where you could do a lot with a dark ride, especially if it's an existing dark ride like Pirates of the Caribbean. And then that actually it could just... through AR, show us footage of the original ride, so that way we could enjoy the way they used to
be.
Right?
Hey, there you go.
There'll be an auction scene. Yeah. Yay! I like that.
That's a fantastic idea.
Yeah.
So I think that AR, for me anyway, at least as an attraction designer, is far more exciting and limitless as far as what we're going to be able to do, even in the short term.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, I totally agree.
I'm all on the AR train. As opposed to VR.
And everybody has a phone.
Yeah.
You know, so that, I mean,
I would totally go on a hunt for the cattywampus and do Ghost Town.
Because we were there, we did Ghost Town Alive yesterday. And one of the things that they've done is cattywampus is not there because he's escaped and they have the wooden, gate collapsed where he broke out. And I'm just thinking, well, maybe that's a storyline that one of the actors is talking about there, but we didn't bump into that. Mm-hmm. But if you go into it knowing, or if there was a wanted poster there next to it said, the Catawampus has escaped, fire up your, whatever, and be able to do that and go off looking through the park for the Catawampus running around.
That'd be
freaking
fun.
Cool, is that, right?
It's really fun, yeah.
And I think that that's coming. I think you're going to see that at Haunt. We'll loop it back to the Haunt stuff, right? Could you imagine walking through Scary Farm at night and using your phone and you're looking up at the windows in Ghost Town and you can see creepy things looking out at you or things flying through the air above you or in the trees, crouching, looking. There's a whole entire realm that can open up once you start messing with AR.
Yep.
Nice.
That's great. People are already looking at their phones walking through Frog Alley.
Yeah.
Well, as ride designers, and Ted, I'm sure, runs into this too, as experienced designers, you can't fight this, so you've got to embrace it.
Yep.
Absolutely.
You're not going to pull people away. I mean, I've already, during the podcast, looked and checked my messages, while we're talking. You're not gonna tell people, look, you're at Haunt for the next 6 hours. Leave your phone in the car. That's not happening.
Mm-hmm. No.
So unless you absolutely embrace it and figure, okay, how can we use this as a tool that we don't have to pay for?
Yeah.
Because the guest has already paid for it. They've done the heavy lifting. How do we use this to plus our experience for everybody? Unless you think that way, you've already lost the battle.
No, I totally agree.
Yeah, there's no other way.
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely talked about it and worked on different testing and things. But everything from Q Entertainment or whatever. Because... not Scary Farm or HHN or any of these bigger, and just regular theme parks. I mean, you're spending so much time in line, so there's an opportunity there to help with story, experience, whatever it is. Because, again, everybody has their phone anyways.
Yeah.
Yeah, Busch Gardens Tampa used to do that. They had the little QR codes in the queue line. You could scan it with your phone and give you a little video with a backstory.
And I think that's way ahead of the curve.
Yep.
In their case for that. And I think that now that everything is GPS based, it knows, hey, you're in the Shining queue, or hey, you're in this queue, or that.
Well, if you can get service out in Universal.
Well, that's going to be the park's problems, Disney.
Yeah.
And they are aware. I mean, these companies are very aware that their infrastructure really needs to be updated. Universal in Orlando is the best experience I've had as far as Wi-Fi everywhere. I mean, I get great Wi-Fi in the station at Gringotts.
Mm-hmm.
Did you really?
And that's like a bunker, right?
Wow,
and it's perfect. You can Periscope in there. You can do whatever. So Universal Orlando's on it. It can be done. It's just it's expensive. It's bringing broadband basically to everybody. You've got 80,000 people in your park, like at Disneyland or whatever.
Yeah.
That's a hell of a lot of broadband.
Yeah.
But they can afford it. And they're going to have to if they're going to implement these things.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we are within a few years of seeing some really big steps.
I agree.
I think that way.
I totally
agree. Especially since all the parks already have their own apps.
Yeah.
It knows you're in line for Big Thunder. So you go into the Big Thunder app or whatever.
Now.
Yep. Yeah. And suddenly you're a miner and you're looking for hidden golden nuggets in the queue. At Big Thunder, and you're playing with your friends to see who can collect the most golden nuggets. I mean, the possibilities are endless
yeah.
for this kind of thing, and it's coming. It's not a pipe dream. This stuff is coming online.
Totally.
Do you think that's something that you can add to Midsommar Scream? Like they have to find certain monsters. I know you had the scavenger hunt, the game.
Yeah, we did, and it was well received, and there were a lot of people that played it. The concern was the connectivity.
Yeah.
Right. So when we were setting up Midsommar, we can get great LTE or whatever, but as soon as you cram, you know, thousands of people in there and everybody, including vendors, are on their phones trying to ring up sales and things like that, the broadband suddenly becomes very thin band and then non-existent band.
Yeah.
So our challenge going into that at Midsommar was it's got to be able to be played offline. If people, I mean, you can have an amazing game, but if you suddenly are relying on connectivity that's not there, it's just a puff of smoke that just disappears, all that hard work. So that's the challenge with a venue like Midsommar, because you have a third party that controls the bandwidth in there, and it ain't cheap.
Yeah.
And that's how they're there to make money, right? They're going to charge the hell out of people for bandwidth. Now, I think that in coming years, when entire cities provide broadband, and that's coming too, then that becomes a little bit more obsolete. And then we look to the future and say, sure, you're going to be able to do all sorts of location-based games with your phones and all that. Absolutely. For now, it's just where we are at with technology. I think it's limited to what we have available to us at whatever particular venue we're operating at.
Yeah.
But it's good to have that forward-thinking mindset of knowing where the technology is going so that you can have that kind of in the wings and ready so that when it is there, you can just, boom, have it ready.
Oh, yeah.
And then that way your audience is already ready to receive it.
Yeah, I mean, we have to. I mean, and it's getting there. I mean, Snapchat knows when you're at Midsommar Scream and you have your Midsommar Scream, you know, overlays to put on your, you know, pictures and videos that you're taking. So, I mean, it's there. It's just got a little bit more getting there to be done before we can use it on a large scale, I think.
Yeah.
So as we're wrapping up, what are you guys looking forward to for the haunt season this year? Anything you guys are particularly looking forward to
checking out? Into the Black. I'm really excited to see what these guys have done with Into the Black. It's a weird haunt season because there's not a lot of, and this is great for Larry, there's not a lot of new stuff coming online.
Yeah.
You know? Especially
guys are not.
Especially like on the independent level,
there's
not very much at all. I mean, I usually use Rick's sort of list of...
It's gone up. The haunt directory's already gone up.
Yeah, and so I bookmark that every year, especially when it comes to like locating like the home haunts and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And you know, without like the delusions and stuff like that, there, you know, there's some pretty heavyweights that are not going to be around. And so that is good for Into the Black. You know, I'm always looking forward to, you know, to what, you know, Knott's does, what Horror Nights does. Next week, from the date that we're recording this, Knott's is going to have their event where they sort of announce everything, and Universal's still in the process.
He will be there.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Okay. And so, Universal's still in the process of finishing up their announcement, same as Orlando. You know, getting through as many as we can. I mean, was it last year, the year before, where you went through like 40 haunts or something one?
I think last year, I want to say it was 52. We had 52 stops last year.
That's insane. Cool. You know?
It's insane.
I am looking forward to Hobbs Grove. And so that's going to be exciting. There'll be some things there that I'm interested in seeing. And maybe we can persuade Rick to...
We got to give a shout out to Vince Carrillo because he busts my balls every year to go see. And now he got Sean and Carmel. They finally went from Parks and Cons. They finally went and they loved it. They thought it was great.
Yeah.
It's a commitment though.
It is.
Not a 20-minute drive. It's not a 2-hour drive. It's a drive.
Now you need a hotel room that
Yeah.
Night.
I mean, it's a drive and that's a weekend destination. I mean, you're going to see that.
Paul Lynch did a turnaround.
That's insane.
Which is crazy.
Right.
Yeah. Did he get to work haunt that night?
Yeah, he worked haunt.
Oh, God, that's not good.
So it's crazy. and we've done things like that. I mean, we did a turnaround. It was last year before. It all kind of blends together. But, I mean, we did a turnaround where we went and did a bunch of haunts in San Diego and drove back the same night.
Wow.
And that's rough. I think we did it like on a Sunday night or something too. So we had work in the next morning. We are going to go to Las Vegas.
And do The Walking Dead, the fear of The Walking Dead.
We almost got to do that. We were there the weekend following Midsummer. Mm-hmm. And it was like a hair away from being ready. And we tried so hard to get in to get a look at it. Yeah. And it just wasn't ready because they were like in their last minute, oh my God, we're about to open mode. So that didn't work out. But here's the interesting discussion that we just had yesterday about this is, you know, we're going to, this afternoon while we're recording this, we're going to go see the It attraction that's in Hollywood. And yes, we're going to see Walking Dead when we go. But then the question was, well, do these count as our haunt stops, you know, for this year? Because they're not built specifically for Halloween as haunted attractions. Mm. So I would say, no, they don't count. Yes, they're going to be stops, but they don't count towards our tally, you know, this year.
And the It thing actually isn't even going to be open.
Of course not.
Well, it's
marketing. Yeah. So they're awesome, and we're looking forward to them, but they don't count for the Halloween, you know, tally. Mm-hmm. But there are great things that we're going to check out. We're going to check out, you know, Fright Dome, which even though I lived in Vegas for 3 years, I've never seen Fright Dome.
Yeah.
And it's impressive, some of the IPs that they actually work with.
Yeah.
You know, they've had some really heavy hit. And Five Nights at Freddy's. Mm-hmm. Which that's kind of the elusive, you know, IP that's kind of on everybody's radar, but nobody's done it. I mean, they've done it.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. And then, of course, Freakling Brothers, who is in North Vegas. And, oh my God, so excited to do. Those guys are great. They're wonderful.
They're really cool.
And we hope to do something with them and have them represented back with us at Midsummer 18. Ooh. And, you know, so we're going to do the Vegas thing for a weekend. So we try to every Halloween season get out of Southern California to see how other people do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because it is different. And you can tell that it is different, even though it's the same looks like, smells like kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it is different.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's important to us. We've gotten to the point where it's like the tally is so ridiculous. And it's so daunting. We just don't even think about it.
Yeah.
We just do it. And Sean Marshall is really good. Sean keeps a tally of everything. And as we go, he's like, well, we've been to this many and you've been to this many. It's amazing.
Wow.
He keeps the books. Oh, my God. He's so organized. It's ridiculous. I'm the exact opposite.
Yeah.
So it's always funny. At the end, we're like, oh, my God, we did a lot of stuff. And then they say, well, you did 52. And you're like, holy crap. That's a lot
that's
of
so
stuff.
Crazy.
We can add, you guys need to add Coffin Creek.
So we have not done Coffin Creek for a while, so we will see about working that one in.
Veronica and I are managing.
Are you?
Yeah.
Tell us what you're doing. So the listeners know, too. What are you guys doing?
So at Coffin Creek this year, Veronica is completely in charge of wardrobe now. She's taking over the wardrobe thing, and she's going to be running the Asylum attraction.
Okay.
And then I'm going to be running the Haunted Trail attraction.
Okay.
Yeah, all right. So it should be fun. And then there's some new stuff coming up. They're bringing back the Hayride.
Okay.
And another attraction, which is actually being run by a group of zombie LARPers.
Okay.
And it's not part of what we're doing, but it's all going to be included in the ticket. So they're going to be doing something cool. And their costumes and everything are amazing. So hopefully they know how to run a haunt. But we'll find out.
Okay. Well, they're storytellers as lawyers, so at least they have a really good base to start from.
Sure.
Because you can be really good at design and lighting and everything, but if you're not telling a story, then... But these guys really know how to tell a story and sell that story, so at least they have that. And if the haunt isn't, like, the best their first time, it will definitely get better and better. Mm-hmm. So I actually have a lot of faith in them. I think they're going to do great.
I think they're going
to
do good, too.
But I think that this year, Coffin Creek is one to go to, not just because we are going to work there and we want people to come, but we're working on solidifying the storylines and speaking of stories to be told. It has been known to be kind of mishmash in places, but this year they really want to focus on cleaning their stories and making it, you know, a much more consistent arc throughout their venues. So that's the focus this year. It's the same layout, same mazes, but they're going to be cleaner and they're going to make more sense and they're going to be more involved for the audience.
Yep.
So if it's been, if you've been wishy-washy on Coffin Creek in the past, I do recommend you go this year and see. And then that's just kind of like cleaning up what you have, and then we'll build next year. So next year there are plans to add more venues and possibly change stories on existing venues. Not sure, but it'll be bigger. But, you know, we don't want to build on something that's kind of like, you want to make sure that the foundation is strong. Mm-hmm. So that's the idea behind Coffin Creek this year.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's going to be fun.
Yeah.
It's going to be great.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right, so where can people find you guys?
ThemeParkAdventure.com, MidsummerScream.org, and then play with your Google and find us on all the social media platforms. We're out there.
Vinted?
Me? I guess Ultimate Haunt is still around.
How many years is Ultimate Haunt now?
Jeez, I think it's like 18.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
It's a long time.
You're old.
But yeah, I mean, I'm around on Facebook or whatever, so, you know, or if you see me at any of these haunts, come say
and
hi.
And if you want to buy tickets for Into the Black, are there still tickets? I don't know. I know they were on sale a while ago.
It's intotheblack.biz, and I think tickets are still available, so if you're interested in that type of thing, definitely go check it out.
What is the name of the VR production company that you're working with?
Hollow Studios. Okay. So that's hollowstudios.com.
Excellent. All right.
And you can follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Tales from the Fog. You can follow the Decay Brigade on YouTube at youtube.com/Decay Brigade Official. Since I run that, so I'm going to plug it. You can follow Veronica at Veronica Voices on Instagram. And I believe that's it. So until next time, guys, we'll see you in the fog.
Bye, guys.